Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Dale Guthmiller. Mr. Larry, is it Mamula?
Mamula,
all right. Is from Dakota Plains Legal Services is representing the appellant, and Mr. Frank Geegan, Assistant Attorney General, is representing the State of South Dakota. The appellant may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Justices, Madam Justice, Madam Clerk, Counsel. May it please the court. Forgive me, this morning this is my maiden voyage before this court. Even though I have been practicing for about 18 years, I've had the fortune, or I guess misfortune, of not having to do this before, so please bear with me. This nightmare, I guess, for lack of a better term, this whole case began for Dale Guthmiller on July 12th of 2001 when on a car ride up through the Black Hills, Northern Hills, with the mother of RB, the child victim in this case, when she presented him, hit him over the head, in essence, with the statement that he had molested her four-year-old daughter. And at that time, and up until the time preceding that time, Mr. Guthmiller was in a very high degree of stress from work. He ran a motorcycle shop, working practically 24 hours a day. After a number of years of sobriety, he had taken to using methamphetamine to keep himself going, and he was essentially under the influence of this for a number of weeks, both prior to and on the day of this particular trip. And on this trip, it was testified, Melissa Bonham, RB's mother, testified that when she confronted Mr. Guthmiller with these allegations, that he had done something of a sexual nature to her daughter, depending upon which stage of the proceedings at trial, she essentially hinted that that he admitted it. In prior proceedings, she had testified that no, he didn't admit it, he didn't deny it. What he did say and what she testified to at trial is you know, you're nuts. I don't remember any of this. I don't remember what happened that day. Let's get some help. I'll go see a psychiatrist. We moved to have this statement excluded on the basis that it was much more prejudicial than probative, since there was never an actual admission, and we assigned that as one of our assignments of error. But the crux of this case to get down to, and I'll try and, you know, I guess fold it back in later, is that what this case boils down to is the convergence of issues relating to the competency of the child witness of this case, the admission of her statements that she had made to various persons prior to trial. Now, when this case first started, she had made a statement to Betty McGee, her grandmother, that Wrench, and Betty McGee testified to this at the trial, where it was originally testified to that Wrench licked my bottom. At trial, Betty McGee testified that Wrench licked my butt. She told her mother, Sherry Kaler, and this originally when she made the statements to her mother, Wrench licked my butt. She told Misty Gray, who did the initial interview, taped interview with her, that Wrench licked my butt, and it was only after Misty Gray referred to it as a bottom that Raynan started referring to it as a bottom. And as these proceedings went on, and until finally we got to the point of trial, she started referring to the area as of what Mr. Guthmiller supposedly licked was her pee-pee. Now, when you're when the court looks at the record and sees the progression of these things, And she also did diagrams with Misty Gray. Not once did she identify any area as her butt. She called the front of her down below. She called that her bottom. This was toward the end of the interview when they were doing the body parts on the sheet at trial. She also, and that is an exhibit in this case, labeled and circled areas. But her mother testified, and this, I believe, Your Honors, is extremely important, that her and Raynon had never really talked about what these things were called. She really didn't know what a butt was. She didn't know what a bottom was. She really didn't have any word for vaginal area. She just called it down there. So, you know, I guess when you look at, when you have a little girl calling something a butt, and her mother testifying she doesn't know what a butt is, we would contend on that basis and the conflicting names and how she named these things, that these statements, for those reasons among others, should have caused the trial judge to determine that these statements were not reliable and they shouldn't have been admitted. In addition, when this child was asked what the truth was, and this is another interesting progression in how this trial went and these whole proceedings went. The first time the question of what a truth or a lie came up with was in the interview to Misty Gray. Misty Gray asked her, asked the little girl, do you know what a truth is? And she shook her head no. After further questioning, when she asked, do you know what a lie is? She said, a lie is when you hit someone. And it was only after Misty Gray's prompting where she said, no, Raynon, you know, that's not what a lie is. A lie is something that's not real. And then that's where, you know, they took it from there. She got a little better in explaining the difference at the preliminary hearing and again at the motions hearing and again at the trial. But initially, when this thing really counted, when it should have been done in a manner in which to ensure that this statement and all subsequent statements were going to be reliable, it wasn't done, and Your Honors, it just tainted the whole thing.
It appears to me that everything that you've argued so far this morning is all either a discretionary call by the trial court or it's a credibility issue for the jury. Now, is there anything that you take issue with this morning so far that would fall outside of those two categories?
Well, no, and what we're arguing, what we've argued, you know, in the brief, Your Honor, is that the trial judge abused his discretion in determining that these things were reliable. They were not reliable, according to when you're looking at Buller and Flood and Thompson. Those cases, the reliability of the assertions, you know, and all of these inconsistencies, and the fact that she couldn't tell, you know, what a truth, you know, from a lie was, just takes us out of the ballpark.
How much of this? How many of these inconsistencies were presented to the jury during the trial?
I believe most, if not all of them, were, Your Honor.
And the child did testify also. So
yes,
not only was her statement used, her prior statement, but the child was on the stand and could be examined by about what she was saying then and about what she said before.
That's correct.
Does that ameliorate, do you think, the problems with the statement that you see?
No, Your Honor, because I think that, you know, it's initially when you have a situation, especially when you have one, two, three, four other people testifying to these assertions, you know, what it amounts to, it doesn't ameliorate it. I think it exacerbates it by the pure repetition. And these things, and we assert, Your Honor, that because for the factors that I've just stated and what is in our brief, that the court should have ruled the child wasn't competent to testify. These statements were not reliable, and even if they were, if the child was not competent to testify, these statements should not have come in, since she would have not been able to testify. She would have been unavailable, and therefore there should have been corroboration required before the statements were admitted. You know, it's, I guess what I'm getting at is these things are all linked, they're all intertwined, trying to separate one from the other is extremely difficult. The trial judge also, I guess to top things off, is prior to the child testifying at the trial. Now, before the child testified, the only inkling that the jury had of what the actual allegations were when the mother testified for the state as a second witness, and she testified basically what the child told her was that Wrench licked my butt. And that was it. The mother testified she didn't ask the child further, didn't inquire as to any of the specifics of the offense with the child or anything. So that was the only thing the jury heard regarding the allegations prior to the child testifying. Now, when the child got up to take the stand, the trial judge made the comment that I've had a chance to watch RB testify before, saw her in the videotape, and the court has ruled she's competent. That means she's able to remember stuff and relate what she saw. And RB, we talked about all this before, and you indicated you just tell what happened and wouldn't make things up. We contend, Your Honors, that this statement by the judge in front of the jury before the child testified, in essence, and could have, and we assert was, taken by the jury as the stamp of approval by the trial court on the child's testimony and what she was accusing the defendant of. Now, and this, you know, we've laid out the case law. We contend that the Rush case out of Illinois would control this case. Well, we have to contend with this court's ruling in Al-Adani as well. But this case is different from Al-Adani. In Al-Adani, the child had already testified. The jury had already seen her, heard her, and had the opportunity to make up their minds as to her believability, her credibility, before the judge said anything. In Al-Adani, if I remember correctly, the judge made the objectionable comment when the child was getting up on the stand on rebuttal. It was done in the context of her not having to take the oath again, and that is how the trial judge explained the ruling to counsel and to the defendant the next morning, I believe, when...
Give me the context here, this one. Was there an objection in front of the jury to the child's competence?
No.
You had already made your record on that.
I believe so, Your Honor. Throughout when the state filed their motions to have all of this testimony allowed.
So was the child was given some kind of an oath, and then the judge made this comment, or was this before the oath, or what?
Well, when the judge made the comment and Raynan, we talked about this before, and you indicated you just tell what happened and wouldn't make things up.
That was the oath.
And then the judge made the comment, and Raynan, RB, said yes, and the court said the court will take that as the oath.
So that basically, the court, they didn't have, of course, the child was only 5 at the time she testified, I understand.
That's correct.
So having her raise her right hand and give an oath would not have been very meaningful for a 5-year-old.
Not, you know, there are, you know, and we don't argue, you know, that a child of that age, Your Honors, is required to go through that kind of a litany.
So the judge would have to say, wouldn't the judge have to say something in front of the jury so that the jury knows that the child is expected to speak the truth? Well, I mean, instead of giving an oath, the judge would have to say something and say, all right, I acknowledge this to be equivalent to an oath.
That is perhaps the case, Your Honor.
You know, the judge hasn't really put his stamp of approval on what she has to say here. He said in front of the jury that she has indicated that she will tell it as the way it happened and so forth. In other words, all he's doing is bringing up to the jury the fact that she has said it that way, and that's enough for an oath. But he didn't go on to say, and I find her to know what she's saying, and I find, you know, and I find her to be competent, or any words like that.
Yes, he actually did, Your Honor.
Where was that?
Prior to that time, and this is in that same paragraph on page 159 of the first part of the trial transcript, and the comments that that we feel are objectionable is I've had a chance to watch RB testify before, saw her in the videotape, and the court has ruled she's competent. That means she's able to remember stuff and relate what she saw.
He has to make that finding, though, doesn't he? He does have to, at some point, make a finding that the witness is competent. And, of course, with a five-year-old, that's mandatory, isn't it? A judge has to make that finding.
Well, a judge has to make the finding, Your Honors, but we submit that it shouldn't be done in front of the jury, and especially in the context of what the judge went on to say regarding, you know, her competence.
Well, doesn't he still instruct the jury at the end of the trial that they are the sole judges of credibility?
Yes, he does, but that's, you know, I guess that's closing the barn door after all of the cows get out, Your Honor. Before the child testifies, we submit that this statement essentially says to a jury, to 12 people off the street, you know, that, hey, you know, the judge is saying, you know, she's a good witness and she's believable, and that taints it in the jury's mind. Before she even says one word in testimony, they're thinking that the boy, the judge thinks this child is one to be believed.
But then the jury was instructed that they're the sole judges of the credibility of the child who has testified in this case, right?
That's correct.
Before you run out of time, could you talk a little bit about the last issue that you raised on the sentencing part of it? On the habitual criminal sentencing issue that you addressed.
Our position that I guess two things, Your Honor. Number one, the habitual offender provision shouldn't apply in this case because the criminal pedophilia statutes already have the enhancement mechanism built in by, you know, the first offense being a class one, and the second offense, you know, being a class B mandatory life without any parole. And what we are arguing, but besides the Eighth Amendment, we would submit to the court that I know in the past the court has given much deference to the legislature and their decisions on what punishments for particular crimes, you know, are supposed to be. But we would submit, and I guess while I've got you here, you know, I guess it's my feeling that we need to get to a point some way. This court, some court needs to say, enough is enough. We'll give you great deference, but, you know, we have a constitutional amendment out there, that prohibits, I guess, in essence, the death penalty, I won't use that term, but that prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. And we're considering, you know, in this case, given this defendant, his past history, his lack of past history as far as violence, or doing any prior allegations as far as this, life is too much.
You have said that. You say we should say that, but I think we've said it in Bolt, and we've said it in Bonner, that there are certain sentences were too high and were cruel and unusual.
Yes, you have. It's at a position where, in certain specific cases and certain specific crimes, to say that, hey, look, enough is enough. With my 20 seconds left, you have a situation here with, maybe I'll address that on rebuttal since I'm running out of time, and that'll take a few minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Geagan.
20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As you've heard from Mr. Manimala, the defendant has raised a host of issues on appeal. Before getting to those arguments, however, the state would like to take just a moment to briefly comment on the facts. As you no doubt know from reading the briefs, the victim was a 4-year-old child whose mother happened to work for the defendant at his motorcycle shop known as Rent and Repair. It was not uncommon for the mother to take the child with her to work. On the afternoon in question, July 9th of 2001, an individual by the name of Don Rice came in asking for the defendant. After walking through the shop area, Rice told the victim's mother that the defendant wasn't there. It was then that she noticed that her daughter was also missing. She initially thought that the defendant had simply taken the child to a nearby store for ice cream. As he was getting ready to leave a short time later, however, Rice noticed the defendant and the victim coming out of the men's bathroom together. The child ran up to her mother stating she wanted to go home. Her mother testified that the child was very agitated and didn't want to be around anybody else. She just wanted to be alone with her mother. Instead of taking the child with her to work the following morning, she made arrangements for her mother to babysit. It was while the child was playing in the backyard with a young friend that the grandmother overheard the child say something to the effect that he won't let me play with the kittens. It was only after the victim repeated this over and over again that the grandmother finally asked who she was referring to. The child, however, indicated that it was a secret. Shortly thereafter, without any prompting whatsoever, the child blurted out, "Grandma, it was Wrench. He licked my butt. He said it was a secret, and if I told anyone, he wouldn't let me play over the kittens." Since the child continued to repeat this in front of her friend, the grandmother said, "We're not going to talk about this anymore, but you're going to have to tell your mom." When she was taken home, later that evening, the child again repeated what had happened and told her mother, "The defendant licked my butt." She was later interviewed by authorities on July 12th of 2001, and once again indicated that she'd been sexually molested. When asked to tell the investigators where she'd been touched, the victim pointed to her vaginal area and said, "In the front." The defendant maintained at trial, and I quote, "It was just me and the victim, so whatever was said would be hearsay, it's all hearsay." His principal argument on appeal is therefore that the trial court erred in allowing witnesses to testify regarding the victim's out-of-court statements. It should be noted at the outset, however, that a question exists as to whether this issue is even properly before the court. This court has said on numerous occasions that an objection must be raised at the trial level in order to properly preserve the issue. Here the record reflects that the defendant did not object when any of his testimony was elicited from the witnesses. Even if you could say for sake of argument that the issue is properly before the court, the state would submit that the defendant's argument lacks any merits. It is well established that the trial court's evidentiary rulings are presumed correct. In order to assert those findings on appeal, the defendant must show that there was an abuse of discretion. The question is not whether this court would have made an original-like ruling, but simply whether a judicial mind in view of the law and circumstances could reasonably have reached that conclusion. In the instant case, the state, prior to trial, gave notice of its intent to offer these statements pursuant to SDCL 19-16-38, the so-called tender years exception to the hearsay rule. Under that statute, the statements of a minor victim of sexual abuse are admissible if the trial court, after hearing, determines that the circumstances provide sufficient initial reliability and the child either testifies or is unavailable. If the child is unavailable as a witness, the statute requires that there be corroborating evidence. Since the victim in this case did testify, there's no need for corroboration. The only issue, therefore, is whether the statements were reliable. In that regard, this court has identified several factors to be considered when making a determination. They include the child's age and maturity, nature and duration of abuse, relationship of the child to the offender, the child's capacity to observe, recall, and communicate, any possible motive for the child to fabricate or lie, and the child's susceptibility to suggestion. The trial court in the instant case conducted not one but two separate pretrial hearings to determine whether or not the statement should be admitted. After listening to the child's videotaped statement, as well as considering the other testimony presented by the state, the trial court had no difficulty in finding that the requirements of the statute had been met. As indicated in his findings of fact and conclusions of the law dated November 19th, the victim, without any prompting or coaching whatsoever, repeated on separate occasions that she had been sexually molested by the defendant. According to the trial court, there was no evidence of any reason for the child to fabricate, such as divorce, custody dispute, ill will, or any animosity between she and her mother, between her mother and the defendant. The court specifically found, and I quote, because of the child's young age, it was almost impossible to believe that the child related this story for any other reason than its purpose. The court stated, quote, it's important to note that the child is telling a secret that she's told not to tell. There were repercussions, something that would have a definite effect on her, that being not being able to play with kids. As far as the child states to the grandmother, the court found it significant to note that she was overheard talking with her friend. There again was no evidence of any prompting by the grandmother. Although the grandmother did ask various names of who she's referring to, the court found it important that the child came up with a totally different name, the name of the defendant. In the court's view, all of these things serve to establish the reliability and trustworthiness of the statements. The defendant doesn't seem to contest those findings, but argues instead that the court erred in its decision because the child somehow supposedly contradicted herself. She told her mother, the defendant licked my butt, whereas the grandmother testified at trial, I think she said bottom, licked my bottom, but I don't know. The defendant also attempts to fault the young child for using the word pee-pee when testifying at trial. The state, however, would submit that whether the child, in referring to vaginal area, used the words butt, bottom, or pee-pee, didn't lessen her credibility to any degree. The defendant's argument fails to take into account the victim's young age and obvious developmental limitations in describing sexual behavior. Her mother testified that the child didn't know the difference between her vaginal area and her butt. According to her mother, they simply did not talk about those type of things. The state, therefore, would submit that any alleged inconsistencies in the child's statements can simply be attributed to her young age.
In this case, it was the all of the evidence, though, really came from the child. There was no other corroborating evidence physically or otherwise. Isn't that true?
There was a certain degree of corroboration in that Don Rice, a witness for the defendant, didn't testify that he observed the child and the defendant coming out of the bathroom together. When asked how long he thought the defendant had been in the bathroom, he indicated around 10 minutes. That testimony is consistent with the victim's statements that she and the defendant went to the bathroom for about 15 minutes. The record reflects that the child also told the mother that it hurt to go potty and that she started to have nightmares. The mother testified that it finally got to the point where she started sleeping with her, the child wouldn't and couldn't sleep alone. The state would submit that this testimony served to corroborate the child's statements. Finally, the victim herself took the witness stand and was subject to cross-examination. The jury, therefore, had the opportunity to hear the victim herself testify that she had been sexually molested. They were in the best position to determine the credibility and obviously concluded that she was telling the truth. That then brings us to the defendant's next argument, that being that the trial court erred in finding the child was competent to testify. There is, however, no arbitrary age which prohibits or precludes a child from being competent. The child may only have the ability to observe, recall, and communicate, as well as some sense of moral responsibility. As this court has indicated in the past, the decision whether a child is competent is one best left to the discretion of the trial court, since evidence of the child's intelligence and ability to recall and relate is not fully portrayed by the record. Here, the trial court had the opportunity to observe the victim testify at a motion hearing on November 6, 2001. The transcript of that hearing shows that the child testified that she knew the difference between the truth and a lie and always tried to tell the truth. She also testified that she knew it was bad to lie. When asked what happened, if she lied, the victim responded, "You get spanked." The trial court stated on the record that the deputy state's attorney did an amazing job in qualifying the child as far as knowing the difference between right and wrong, truth and a lie, and also assuring the court that she would do her best to testify truthfully. In the court's view, the child's testimony showed a remarkable ability for a four-year-old to recall and relate what happened. The court found, and I quote, she had clearly gone over the competency bar. That then leads to the defendant's third argument, is that the trial court somehow committed a reversible error when commented in the presence of the jury. I've had a chance to watch a child testify before, and I saw her on a videotape, and the court has ruled that she's competent. That means that she's able to remember stuff and relate what she saw.
Did the trial court do that in front of the jury?
As indicated in the state's brief, it's common for the trial court to make evidentiary rulings in the presence of the jury. The state will submit that there's nothing improper in the court attempting to explain its evidentiary ruling as a matter of law. The state will submit that any possible prejudice to the defendant was eliminated as a result of the trial court's subsequent instructions to the jury regarding credibility. The jury was specifically admonished that, as in the case of all other witnesses, you are the sole judges of the credibility of the child who testified here today. The jury is further admonished that the actions of the court during the trial, in ruling on motions or objections by counsel, or in comments to counsel, or in setting forth the law to these instructions, are not to be taken by you as any indication of an opinion by the court as to how you should determine these facts. These instructions are comparable to those given in Al-Adani, and the state was submitted as more than adequate to eliminate any possible prejudice to the defendant. The last issue the state would like to briefly touch on is the defendant's argument that the trial court erred in relying on enhancement provisions of SDCL 22-7 in imposing a life sentence. Based on the defendant's prior felony convictions, his conviction for criminal pedophilia was enhanced to a Class B felony.
Wasn't that prior conviction like 9 or 10 years before that, and it was a lower level felony?
I don't recall the specific dates, but the two prior convictions were for drug-related offenses. I believe one was for possession of a controlled substance, and the other was for attempted to distribute a controlled substance.
Just one was found to be the basis for Part 2, is my recollection.
Right. I think under the statute, it requires simply one or more prior convictions to enhance. Now, the defendant attempts to minimize the seriousness of his prior convictions by argument that they did not involve any violence. That argument, however, ignores the prior recognition by this court of the perils that drugs pose to society, and that the sale and use of drugs destroyed countless victims of all ages. The state finds even more offensive the defendant's suggestion that he did not use any force in molesting the child in this particular case, and that she therefore did not suffer from any physical injury.
In the enhancement for second-time pedophilia, there is no Part 2 filed, is there, on that? How does that work?
I believe the charge of the second offense on criminal pedophilia, 22-23-34.1, since the second offense is mandatory life, I believe there would be a need to file a Part 2.
Okay.
In this particular case, however, the defendant wasn't charged with second offense criminal pedophilia, but a first offense, the state would therefore submit that the provisions of 22-7 should apply. The defendant has not pointed to any legislative directive or mandate that these statutes can't be applied in tandem.
Was he apprised of that when he was arraigned then as well? That's what he's facing?
That I don't recall. I apologize to the court.
Well, these statutes were not applied in tandem, as I understand
no.
the record.
There was no enhancement under SDCL 22-30.1 since it wasn't being a second offense criminal pedophilia.
So unlike the Carroll case, the state was not attempting to use
double enhancement.
Both statutes to do a double enhancement.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So which statute should you... Should the law require you to use one or the other, or one to the exclusion of the other?
I believe the cases of sex offense, then the provisions of 22-23-30.1 will control since the mandate is a mandatory life sentence. But in those instances, the first offense criminal pedophilia is dealing with here, there's no indication that the provisions of 22-7 should not apply for enhancement purposes.
Doesn't the Carroll case hold that a specific habitual criminal statute controls over a general habitual criminal statute, and therefore you can only use the pedophilia statute in this case?
But there's nothing in the pedophilia statute which would indicate in the case of the first offense that you completely or simply ignore the defendant's prior criminal history. It would lead to the rather absurd result that a defendant in the facts of this case was charged with first-degree rape, and a 22-22-1 would be subject to enhancement under habitual offender statutes, and that same defendant would avoid any possible enhancement simply as a reason of the expedience of his having been charged and convicted with a violation of 2223.1.
However, it's a very high-level felony. If you could give up to life, at any rate, even if it is a first offense, isn't that correct?
Right. Under 22.6, it being a Class 1 felony, it's subject up to imprisonment in life. The only effect there for the 2223.1 equivalent pedophilia statute has is that it's a mandatory minimum of 25. So even under that statute, the court can still sentence up to life. There's time left, unless the court has any further questions.
Any further questions from the bench? If not, thank you, Mr. Geagan.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mamula, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Just to address a couple of points that Mr. Geagan brought up in his argument. He had indicated that in response to the judge's comments in front of the jury that it is common for the trial courts on occasion to give the rationale for evidentiary rulings in front of the jury. We would submit, Your Honors, that this is not your garden variety evidentiary hearing, but this is a ruling or a statement by a court that goes to the crux, of the case. There's no way with any other type of witness, that a court, can say before that witness testifies I've listened to this witness before. This witness is competent. This witness can is able to remember and relate and recall and narrate facts. It's not like a case where a counsel makes an objection to a question on a certain basis and the judge overrules it. It is admissible. It's not that kind of case. This case, I believe the court in its questioning of Mr. Geagan, I believe it was Justice Meyer Henry, said that in essence, all we have on this case is what RB has said, whether it's on the witness stand at trial or the other statements that she made out of court. And when it comes down to that, in a case such as this, that is ultimately, did the jury ask to determine, is the little girl telling the truth? Did this really happen to her? And is she relating this correctly? A statement like that is deadly in front of a jury.
I know it's difficult to show prejudice in this kind of situation. Maybe we have to presume it, but is there anything you have to show that somehow this prejudiced your client? Tangible?
No, Your Honor, only the circumstances, of the case and how the evidence, ultimately played out. I think it's interesting to know, and all done, that when the trial court was giving its reasons for denying the defendant's motion for a mistrial in that case, the trial court made a specific finding in denying the motion that this court had, observed the jury, while this exchange was going on, and based upon the court's observations of the jury, the court finds that it had no impact on the jury, and that was not done in this case. So we would submit that that's a big difference. Getting back,
what would you say would be appropriate for a trial court to substitute, as opposed to the oath that you would normally give an older adult witness? What should the court have said? Because you have to do something, don't you, to indicate to the jury that in lieu of an oath, this child is also under oath to testify?
I think probably the simplest thing, and again, to tailor it to his age, but a 4 or 5 year old child, you just ask him or her, do you promise that you will tell the truth? Period.
Well,
Well, this trial judge simply said, and you're going to tell the truth, aren't you? Isn't that essentially what he said?
Yeah, but at the end of the prior statements that are the ones we particularly find objectionable.
So you don't find that last part
objectionable? I don't find that last part particularly objectionable if that was, you know, if that was all that the judge had said. You know, prior, the other stuff leading up to it.
The stuff leading up to it, as you describe it, really is just a competency determination, isn't it?
I think, you know, that's what, you know, it's, you know, intended to be, but in the minds of the jury, equating, you know, competency and the words that she has testified before, and she's able to remember stuff and relate, you know, what she saw, by those words, remember stuff, that, you know, what she is testifying to. What she remembers, you know, is what in fact happened. That is what we find objection.
You've only got 4 minutes, 5 minutes left. I don't want you to leave the second time without addressing the habitual question. Okay. And specifically, it appears to me that this case is quite unlike Carroll, because the state is not asking to apply 2 enhancement statutes. They're only applying 1. Am I right in that?
That's correct. But it's our position that where the legislature has deemed, has built in an enhancement provision, you know, in a particular offense, that is a specific enhancement provision for a specific offense. That is an enhancement provision that needs to be used.
But how can they use 30.1 for enhancement, because it only applies to 2 or more pedophilia convictions?
That's correct.
So you're saying just by virtue of the fluke that the charge in this case is pedophilia, as a matter of law, that means that the independent habitual offender statute can never be used?
What it boils down to, Your Honor, yes. It's been said that you know, Mr. Egan brought up that you know, we presume that there's no way the legislature, you know, wants to cause, you know, an absurd, you know, or inconsistent results, you know, when they pass these statutes, especially what we're talking about here regarding sentencing. But I would submit to the court that in the case of this criminal pedophilia statute, in essence, it does away with, in probably 90% of the cases, it does away with the first degree rape statute when you're talking about a child under 10 years of age. We've got a situation here in this criminal pedophilia statute. If you have a person, an adult, 26 years and one day old, and a child 12 years and 364 days old, and he or she commits an act of sexual penetration on that child, just on the basis, I think, you know, and as near as I can tell, you know, a type of age difference here, that this person is looking at criminal pedophilia rather than first degree rape, which the big difference here is you're looking at a 10-year mandatory minimum and a 25-year mandatory minimum for, essentially, if you had a 22-year-old perpetrator and a 6-7, you know, anywhere up to 13-year-old victim, they are looking at a first degree rape charge, but with a mandatory minimum of only 10 years. Now, we have a situation like this where, you know, and this court has, you know, addressed this before, you know, depending upon, you know, I guess various factors, but there's a sense of fairness here where one person commits essentially the same act in the same circumstances as looking at a minimum of 10 years, and then by virtue of this other criminal pedophilia statute we have floating around here, is looking at a mandatory minimum of 25 years.
Are there any other criminal penalties that are that high as far as the mandatory minimum?
No, not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Well, and you've got the other side of this, too. You know, I know the United States Supreme Court is looking at the question of the three strikes laws. Here's a case of a two-strike law, where really two felonies, and he's got life in prison.
And he's got life. Yeah, and that is why we would submit to this court that in situations like this, in habitual offender, situations where, the law, does provide this, that it bumps up so many levels, because of this.
Let me ask you one question, because you're going to run out of time. You acknowledge that your interpretation of these two statutes would prevent enhancement in a case where a defendant has 5 or 10 serious violent prior convictions, felony convictions, and then is charged with pedophilia. Under your, as I understand it, under your argument, the habitual statute could not be used because of to enhance those prior 10 or 5 serious violent felonies, just because this felony is pedophilia. That's the result of your argument, as I understand it.
Correct, because the legislature has said this statute has its own enhancement mechanism.
But following on, it didn't say that the specific words of the habitual statutes do not apply.
No.
And they could have said that, couldn't they?
They could have, yes.
Okay. Don't we interpret statutes as written?
Yes.
They also didn't come along and overrule State versus Carroll, which they have done from time to time over the course of the years.
They've done that from time to time, Your Honor, and no, they did not in this case.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess until 10 o'clock.